Robert Badgerow is the first person in Canada to be tried four times for the same first-degree murder. The Hamilton Spectator has told the story from the very beginning. I'm David Crosby, and this is part four of Covering Diane, a Spectator serial podcast about nearly four decades of our coverage of one murder. Covering a murder case is legally complicated, particularly when it reaches the courtroom. There are laws that dictate what journalists can report at various stages of the legal process. Those standard practices can be confusing enough on their own, but in the Badgerow case, with its unprecedented four trials, two hung juries, numerous appeals, publication bans, and stays, there are more legal acrobatics than any other Hamilton trial in recent memory. To understand the journalistic role in this complex story, it helps to know why coverage of murder trials is so important to a newsroom. Former Spec City editor Carla Amaretta explains.
Well, I think essentially we are there on the public's behalf. It can be a bewildering world for anybody who's unfamiliar with it. So the reporter takes the place, in many cases, of people in the broader community to let them know what's going on, and also trials of significance. And in the early days, there was no such thing as Twitter, so there was no contemporaneous reporting. So people would really look forward to reading the high-profile cases and what had transpired during the day in terms of the testimony given. And it's really an essential role for media to play, because courts and justice are really essential to our democracy, and I think the media really takes that role very seriously, and it's something that's essential to our nation and our constitutional rights and everything that goes along with being part of a citizenry and a community, for that matter.
Retired Spectator court reporter Barbara Brown puts it this way.
Well, I think that the life of an individual in the community is probably of paramount concern. I can't think of anything more important than, first-degree murder is the most serious charge in the Canadian Criminal Code, and that of itself is ample reason to cover a murder trial. But I think, the lives of people in our community, and to be judged by a jury of your peers, is probably nothing more important in a democratic society.
Badgerow's trials have all been by jury, trials that come with restrictions for journalists that do not apply to non-jury ones. Brian Rogers is the Spec's longtime media lawyer. He has worked closely with the newsroom on all of its coverage of the Badgerow trials.
There aren't too many first-degree murder trials without juries. It's virtually mandatory. But jury trials are definitely different from judge-alone trials, because jurors are allowed in Canada to go home every night. They are, accessible to all kinds of media and neighbors and so on. And so the approach taken in Canada is to limit what they can read while they're sitting as a jury at trial. And you can only publish, under the criminal code, what takes place in the presence of the jury. So anything that happens in their absence remains a secret until the end of the trial. And that's designed to protect the impartiality of the jurors and not have them influenced by evidence that's not actually before them at trial in court. So one other important thing, though, even before the trial, there's a period of time, and it's really changed in Ontario over the last couple of decades, where you could be found in contempt of court for anything that you published prior to a jury trial that might jeopardize the fair trial. And obviously, over time, there's certain things that have been regarded as particularly dangerous to publish in that period before trial. And it used to be prior criminal record, again, a predisposition by the jury to believe that the accused is somebody who commits crimes and this is just another one in a series. So that kind of information that makes it look like the accused is a bad guy and deserves to be found guilty or, more importantly, actually did it.
At Badreau's murder trials, the jurors weren't told anything about the fact that he had been charged with the attempted murder of another young woman, Debbie Robertson, or that the charge was eventually stayed. So Barbara Brown and columnist Susan Claremont were prohibited from mentioning anything about Robertson in their coverage of the four murder trials. The journalists knew far more about Badreau than the jurors did.
The jurors are the people who know the least about the case. I mean, even the court clerks hear all the stuff that the judge decides shouldn't be admitted as evidence at trial. So, and lots of other people know even more than reporters, maybe.
Knowing things they are prohibited from writing can be both difficult and frustrating for journalists when covering a trial.
You know, there's this thing that reporters have about having to appear balanced and biased and fair and impartial and all of those things when you're not really feeling it because you know more than the jury knows. That's a little frustrating. You just wish that the jury could have the whole facts. But, you know, I understand why these laws of inadmissibility are made. And that's just one of the things you have to go along with.
When the guilty verdict came in at the end of the first trial, the Spec published what's known as a what the jury didn't hear story, including things like the fact that Badreau was facing an attempted murder charge. That story was published in the newspaper and online. And of course, once a story is published online, it lives there in one form or another forever. So when the Court of Appeal overturned Badreau's guilty verdict and a new trial was set, potential jurors would only have to type in his name online and all kinds of information that was banned, then unbanned, and now banned again was immediately available. Brown and Claremont know their detailed coverage of the case is easily accessible to anyone.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the catches of the current system and the internet is that anyone who wants to look it up is simply free to go on the internet and look it up. And I have often thought in my own mind that those jury members, maybe some of them, do look it up.
I think that's absolutely true. They're not supposed to, and they're not likely to admit it, but the entire Robert Badreau case, all the evidence has been out there for a long time. And even when jurors couldn't hear all the details, like, you know, the particulars about the phone booth, for instance, it's been out there for anybody to read.
One way the court tries to ensure potential jurors aren't exposed to information covered by a publication ban is to change the venue of a trial. That means, in some cases, that a trial is moved out of the community where the crime occurred and is held somewhere else where there has been less media exposure. Badreau's third and fourth murder trials were held in Kitchener for that reason.
So a change of venue is a very historical and, I guess, historically important weapon in the meager arsenal of defense lawyers before the charter, because the theory was this. The theory was that communities should try people for the crimes committed in that community. So you had people sitting in the jury who were members of the community and knew the background and had a feeling for it. The suggestion when you brought a change of venue application was that you were, as the defense counsel, were alleging that this community was incapable of producing jurors who would try this crime fairly without, you know, being driven by prejudicial or lynch mob type mentality. And so the classic examples that they would use would be the media coverage of the day to show, you know, the frothing that was going on in the community over this crime and have to find the killer and, you know, let's deal with them properly, effectively, quickly. often with a, you know, with an underlying sense of vengeance. You know, the press in Canada in the old days could be pretty radical. So that, and then other things. I mean, you know, there might be meetings, there might be events that happen in the community to support the victim's family. And so all these would be kind of evidence that this community was incapable of fairly trying the accused. And maybe that made more sense with small communities or communities with a real sense of community spirit. I think myself, increasingly, that's untenable. We are much more hooked into a wider world. And to think that a jury in Hamilton would try a case differently from a jury in Kitchener presented with the same facts, I just can't believe. I just don't believe that's the case. But that's the kind of traditional approach the law took to change a venue, and as a way to guarantee or help guarantee a fair trial for an accused.
And the internet must play a role in that as well. I mean, a potential juror in Kitchener really has the same amount of access or almost as much access to news stories about Badgerow as a potential juror in Hamilton just by Googling. I mean, it's right there.
That's absolutely right. It does take a little more effort. You know, I guess the theory is the Spectator is delivered to your Hamilton doorstep every morning, and if you're in Kitchener, you get the record. So it may not have the same coverage of the same crimes, and therefore it's not as much, you know, imbued in the community as it would be. But with the internet and people more and more accessing news from other sources, I agree. I think the change of venue notion becomes more and more untenable.
The true legal test for a potential juror is not whether they know details about the case when they are going through the selection process. It's whether they can set their knowledge and opinions aside and come to a verdict based on the evidence they hear in court.
So the jury system depends on the jurors who are actually sworn in to you know, administer their role at the trial. Those juries are sworn in, and they are told in no uncertain terms by the trial judge, and not just once, but many times, that they are to pay attention to nothing but the evidence that comes out at the trial. Anything that they've read beforehand, anything that they've heard by way of the gossip, rumor mill, etc., is all to be set aside as if it didn't exist. And their focus is entirely on what comes out in court. And the jury system depends on that. There are lots of pronouncements about judges that jurors are not expected to be pure vessels. They are members of the community. They will have heard things. They will have read things. In fact, you want engaged citizens that are not oblivious to everything that's going around, because the oblivious jurors are never going to be the best jurors. So recognizing that, the admonitions given, you know, put everything else that you may have heard, seen, read out of your mind. Focus only on what goes on at trial. Do not go to the internet and try and find information that isn't coming out at trial. Do not gossip with your neighbors, friends, relatives. Keep the focus on what happens in this courtroom. And so during the course of a trial, anytime there's a concern over admissibility of evidence or a certain line of questioning that's being asked of a witness, the judge will ask the jury or arrange for the jury to leave. So all that argument, that discussion, and maybe even some evidence is taking place in their absence. It's during something called a voir dire, which is to see to say, which merely means that it's a motion within the trial to decide whether or not this particular evidence or this line of questioning or this line of argument is admissible before the jury.
Things got even more complex at the end of the second trial. Usually, a ban that prevents the publication of anything that happens in the absence of the jury expires the moment the jurors begin their deliberations. So journalists covering a trial typically have what the jury didn't hear story ready to go online the second the jury goes out.
What happened in this case is very interesting and is becoming somewhat more prevalent. What happened in this case is that before the jury had rendered its verdict, but after, I guess, it had left the room, the trial courtroom, the defense counsel stood up and asked for a publication ban that went beyond what Section 648 of the Criminal Code provides, which is essentially that nothing that happens in the absence of the jury can be published until the jury retires to render its verdict. as soon as that happens, then the media are free to publish what the jury didn't hear, what the jury doesn't know.
To that point, Brian, I mean, yeah. Most reporters, when I'm covering a trial, I have that story already. I'm waiting to go. And the minute the jury heads out to start deliberations, boom, up it goes on our website.
And that's partly based on the fact that during deliberations, unlike during hearing evidence during the trial, during deliberations, the jury is sequestered. So it's holed up in some hotel with guards, and they make sure that the jurors don't see anything on the news or otherwise that could possibly affect their decision making. And in the States, certainly the practice in some cases has been to sequester jurors for the whole trial while allowing the media to publish anything and everything. So their route has been to control what the jury gets to know, totally. But in long trials, it leads to a very fraught and difficult and I suspect very challenging circumstances for jurors. So here we allow the jurors to go home and sleep at night in their own beds. So it's only during the deliberations that they're sequestered. So that means that they can't see what you published when the last juror leaves the room. And that way it's protected as planned. I suspect maybe in the Badgero case, they were dealing with the fact that the first trial had occurred. It didn't have such an order. It was a standard Section 648 ban. So stories were published at the end of the trial that disclosed things like the Debbie Robertson incident that the judge ruled was not similar fact evidence and couldn't be put to the jury. So all that would have come out. And then there was the appeal and the decision by the Court of Appeal that certain evidence wasn't properly admissible and there had to be a new trial. So I think they could more vividly paint a picture of the risk of prejudice in that circumstance. But the gist of it is, I guess, that the requirements of Section 648 were extended past when the jury retired to when the trial was ended or the verdict was rendered. So in either event, a mistrial isn't one of those.
Publication bans must be taken very seriously. Violating them can cause a mistrial or place the journalist and hence the entire newspaper in contempt of court. But mistakes do sometimes happen. During the third trial, a spec reporter with no courtroom experience and no familiarity with the Badgero case was assigned to fill in and cover the proceedings for a day. That reporter wrote a story that talked about the mysterious and critical 911 call made from a phone booth a few days after Diane's murder. That much was fine. But the reporter also mentioned that the phone booth was located just outside of Badgero's workstation at DeFasco. This was contentious information covered by a publication ban that the jury had not been told. The reporter had used past stories as references for the current one and did not realize, nor did any editor who reviewed the story, that the phone booth's location was covered by the publication ban. Spectator managing editor of news, Jim Poling, had to deal with the consequences.
We made an error, and you know, we corrected it as soon as we could, which is very, very rapid. But it, I still personally, I had to go before a judge to explain, and you don't want to be doing that in telling these stories. You don't want to become the story, and it became confusing. It became a sideshow, and frankly, it's not how a paper wants to be part of the administration of justice, with, you know, explaining why you're sorry, how you made a mistake, and frankly, for an editor to go before a judge, it's just not a good feeling.
The judge's extension on the publication ban was intended to last until the second trial came to a verdict. But with jurors unable to reach a unanimous decision, the second trial ended in a hung jury.
So the publication ban continued after the second trial into the third trial, which also resulted in a mistrial. So all this stuff was coopered up in the darkness, so to speak, because you couldn't publish it.
It wasn't until a judge stayed the murder charge against Robert Badgerow, weeks after his third trial also ended in a hung jury, that the extraordinary publication ban was lifted, and the spec could, for the very first time, tell readers the whole story.
At that point, with the stay of proceedings, there's no more trial possible. It's over. And the judge was persuaded to say, yes, the pub ban originally ordered expires once the proceeding has been stayed. So for the panel and spectator, for the first time, it could print everything. It could print everything that had happened in the proceedings. It could print the rulings of inadmissible evidence. It could publish the kinds of arguments and some witnesses who were presented in voir dires that the trial judge ruled were inadmissible. So it meant for the first time that the spectator was free to let the public know everything it knew.
The updated and long-awaited What the Jury Didn't Hear story ran, and Claremont also wrote an ebook that delved even deeper into the case, with exclusive interviews and further details that had not previously been made public. Then, thanks to a Crown appeal and a ruling from the Supreme Court of Canada, a history-making fourth trial was ordered. A publication ban was once again imposed.
And the jury was severely admonished not to look at anything beyond the courtroom and what came out in the proceedings, not to look at the previous coverage, not to go on the internet, not to speculate with friends and family. And who knows? I mean, the very essence of the jury system meets this conundrum. You know, you need average people who are responsible members of the community, to be jurors. On the other hand, these days, responsible members of the community are people that are curious and not only read the media, but go onto Facebook and news sources through the internet that go well beyond anything that any juror could ever have seen previously.
Just as the fourth trial was about to get underway, a truly bizarre twist caught everyone off guard. On the morning of opening arguments, Claremont woke to find a disconcerting email from someone identified as Juror Doe.
Hello. Is there any information you are professionally comfortable with getting from an anonymous member of a jury during an active trial? What about after? Obviously, nothing to ruin the integrity of the trial while it's going on.
It appears to be the only time in Canada that someone claiming to be a juror on a sitting trial has reached out to a journalist covering the proceedings. By about 6 o'clock that morning, Claremont was on the phone with the spec's then city editor, Carla Amaretta.
Absolutely unprecedented in all of my 25 years working in the news industry, where you have someone who is reaching out on behalf of a juror who is sitting on a major case. It was just stunning. And of course, it raised the question of what is our responsibility here? Do we get swept up into the proceedings itself? Because essentially, we knew that there was an opportunity for perhaps impropriety on the behalf of a juror. So if you could imagine having to make that decision of making your way forward, but also then becoming a sort of intervener in the case. And in the end, we had to do the right thing, which was tell the court officials about the communication we had received and the offer we would have received, because to not do that would have been completely irresponsible in our view, and of course could have jeopardized the entire case itself. So in the end, again, the idea of technology has made this so easy now. People can use their phones in ways that's never really been imagined. And I think one of the questions we had was just how someone even came to make this kind of an offer, knowing that jurors are cautioned and cautioned again about the fact they're to speak to no one about anything that goes on in the jury room and any of their deliberations. I don't know that was what Juror Doe was offering, but even to just give the atmosphere of it, or even just that one, what they probably felt was an innocent, you know, email, was enough to set this whole proceeding spinning. And it was really an anxious time, because we knew that the jury knew nothing about our communications with the courthouse officials, and that they were recalled to the courtroom. And essentially, the issue resolved itself, but really that juror had been outed in a way that was probably very, very serious, and they didn't really understand the full repercussions of what could have happened with them in just sending off an email to a journalist.
The next call was to lawyer Brian Rogers.
There have been a few cases in England and in BC where jurors, sitting jurors, have clearly misbehaved, gone on the internet and circulated stuff to other jurors. In one case, an infamous case in Vancouver, a juror started up a relationship with the accused.
that's bad. you shouldn't do that.
Shouldn't do that. Not a good idea. Anyway, you got this email, but we didn't know who it really came from.
We didn't. But what was your advice to me? It was pretty easy for us to decide what we needed to do in that situation.
And normally we'd have solicitor-client confidentiality, but you and Jim have waived it. So, I mean, here, because step one, we had no idea whether this was a hoax or not. And because of that, we really weren't in a position to decide on our own how best to handle it. I suggest, I believe, that you should draw this to the attention of the Crown Attorney as soon as possible, so that they could decide what measures should be undertaken to ensure that this was just a hoax. Because if you were getting such an email, that person, if it really was a juror, even if you didn't take it up and say, great, pass me the goods, they might try somebody else. So there's a risk with somebody like that on a jury that the whole trial would go off the rails and be really a problem. And obviously, from your point of view, it was important not to be perceived as someone who would, even for a minute, think of taking advantage of this kind of situation. And that was an important message to send to the Crown, to the defense, and to the court.
It was quickly decided that Claremont would report the emails to the Crown attorneys and homicide investigators on the Badgerow case.
It led to a whole police investigation. Yeah. It led to Google in California being involved to try and trace the email. It led to the trial not sitting for several days while the investigation happened. It led to a second email that I got from Juror Doe saying, gee whiz, I hope I'm not the reason why the trial is being delayed. And in the end, a juror was released from the jury, although it wasn't entirely clear whether it was the juror who had sent me the email or it was a member of the juror's family, but it was traced back to an IP address at that person's home. So that was that, and I couldn't write about any of it
until
the end of the trial. Right. And then I was able to write about that whole weird
That was extremely
incident.
Weird.
It is legal in Canada for a journalist to interview jurors after a trial. They can discuss what it was like to be on the jury and the impact it had on their life. But they can never talk about what happened during the actual deliberations. That must always be kept secret, according to the Criminal Code of Canada. So we will never know the specific reasoning behind two juries convicting Robert Badgerow, and two who could not come to a verdict.
I've interviewed quite a few Badgerow jurors over the years, and of course there have been more on this case because of the four trials. Over the years, they've all contacted me because I didn't know their names, so they reached out to me wanting to talk to me about their experience.
Once Badgerow's fourth trial got underway, Claremont faced another legal challenge. This was the first Badgerow trial that she live-tweeted from the courtroom.
And I was following the rules and only tweeting about what was happening in the courtroom in front of the jury. But there are lots of people out there who have followed the Badgerow case very carefully over the years. And they were tweeting in response to my tweets and spilling the beans about all kinds of evidence that the jury either hadn't yet heard or was never going to hear. So, I mean, it was strange that there were just members of the public on Twitter who were talking about things that weren't supposed to be talked about.
And how did you handle that?
I reminded my followers repeatedly that I could only report on what happened in the courtroom. I sort of, when I'm tweeting from a trial, I like to use it as an opportunity to also educate people a little bit about what the rules are and how a trial works. But having said that, there are still people who were tweeting lots of things they shouldn't have been. And I just made sure that I didn't reply to them or retweet them or sort of touch that tweet in any way.
While Rogers has been guiding the spec through the legal maze of the Badgerow case, sometimes even making arguments in front of the judges, he gives credit to the journalists who are in the courtroom, constantly making legal decisions on the fly.
Covering crimes, especially one like this, is a real challenge because the public expect, you know, fairness, and yet they want to be informed. And I think the role of a good reporter is never put to a better test than in this context, because they have to not only dig out interesting stuff and yet be fair enough, but they also have to obey a bunch of rules, some of which really don't make any sense. And yet they have to. They have to be cognizant of it. And I have the greatest respect for people who cover these kinds of cases well.
Next time. Covering Diane.
That is one of the neat things about our history with this story, is that really, from a journalism perspective, we've left no stone unturned. I mean, there isn't anybody, including Robert Badgerow himself, involved with this case that we haven't reported on and probably interviewed at one point in time.
Covering Diane is a serial podcast produced by David Crosby and Susan Claremont at the Hamilton Spectator.